He was the first person to state clearly that the moon shines by reflected light, and he accordingly devised a theory of the phases of the moon. This doctrine was so dangerous that the manuscript describing it had to be circulated in secret, an Athenian samizdat. It was not in keeping with the prejudices of the time to explain the phases or eclipses of the moon by the relative geometry of the earth, the moon, and the self-luminous sun. Aristotle, two generations later, was content to argue that those things happened because it was the nature of the moon to have phases and eclipses, mere verbal juggling, an explanation that explains nothing. The prevailing belief was that the sun and the moon were gods. Anaxagoras held that the sun and stars are fiery stones. We do not feel the heat of the stars because they are too far away. He also thought that the moon has mountains, right, and inhabitants, wrong. He held that the sun was so huge that it was probably larger than the Peloponnesus, roughly the southern third of Greece. His critics thought this estimate excessive and absurd. Anaxagoras was brought to Athens by Pericles, its leader in its time of greatest glory, but also the man whose actions led to the Peloponnesian War, which destroyed Athenian democracy. Pericles delighted in philosophy and science, and Anaxagoras was one of his principal confidants. There are those who think that in this role, Anaxagoras contributed significantly to the greatness of Athens, but Pericles had political problems. He was too powerful to be attacked directly, so his enemies attacked those close to him. Anaxagoras was convicted and imprisoned for the religious crime of impiety, because he had taught that the moon was made of ordinary matter, that it was a place, and that the sun was a red-hot stone in the sky. Bishop John Wilkins commented in 1638 on these Athenians, "Those zealous idolaters counted it a great blasphemy to make their god a stone, whereas, notwithstanding, they were so senseless in their adoration of idols as to make a stone their god." Pericles seems to have engineered Anaxagoras' release from prison. But it was too late. In Greece, the tide was turning, although the Ionian tradition continued in Alexandrian Egypt 200 years later. The great scientists from Thales to Democritus and Anaxagoras have usually been described in history or philosophy books as pre-Socratics, as if their main function was to hold the philosophical fort until the advent of Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, and perhaps influence them a little. Instead, the old Ionians represent a different and largely contradictory tradition, one in much better accord with modern science. That their influence was felt powerfully for only two or three centuries is an irreparable loss for all those human beings who lived between the Ionian Awakening and the Italian Renaissance. Perhaps the most influential person ever associated with Samos was Pythagoras, a contemporary of Polycrates in the 6th century BC. According to local tradition, he lived for a time in a cave on the Samian Mount Kirkus and was the first person in the history of the world to deduce that the earth is a sphere. Perhaps he argued by analogy with the moon and the sun, or noticed the curved shadow of the earth on the moon during a lunar eclipse, or recognized that when ships leave Samos and recede over the horizon, their masts disappear last. He or his disciples discovered the Pythagorean theorem. The sum of the squares of the shorter sides of a right triangle equals the square of the longer side. Pythagoras did not simply enumerate examples of this theorem. He developed a method of mathematical deduction to prove the thing generally. The modern tradition of mathematical argument, essential to all of science, owes much to Pythagoras. It was he who first used the word cosmos to denote a well-ordered and harmonious universe, a world amenable to human understanding. Many Ionians believed the underlying harmony of the universe to be accessible through observation and experiment, the method that dominates science today. However, Pythagoras employed a very different method. He taught that the laws of nature could be deduced by pure thought. He and his followers were not fundamentally experimentalists. They were mathematicians, and they were thoroughgoing mystics. According to Bertrand Russell, in a perhaps uncharitable passage, Pythagoras founded a religion of which the main tenets were the transmigration of souls and the sinfulness of eating beans. His religion was embodied in a religious order which here and there acquired control of the state and established a rule of the saints. But the unregenerate hankered after beans and sooner or later rebelled. The Pythagoreans delighted in the certainty of mathematical demonstration, the sense of a pure and unsullied world accessible to the human intellect, a cosmos in which the sides of right triangles perfectly obey simple mathematical relationships. It was in striking contrast to the messy reality of the workaday world. They believed that in their mathematics they had glimpsed a perfect reality, a realm of the gods, of which our familiar world is but an imperfect reflection. In Plato's famous Parable of the Cave, prisoners were imagined tied in such a way that they saw only the shadows of passers-by and believed the shadows to be real, never guessing the complex reality that was accessible if they would but turn their heads. The Pythagoreans would powerfully influence Plato and later Christianity. They did not advocate the free confrontation of conflicting points of view. Instead, like all orthodox religions, they practiced a rigidity that prevented them from correcting their errors. Cicero wrote, "In discussion, it is not so much weight of authority as force of argument that should be demanded. Indeed, the authority of those who profess to teach is often a positive hindrance to those who desire to learn. They cease to employ their own judgment and take what they perceive to be the verdict of their chosen master as settling the question. In fact, I am not disposed to approve the practice traditionally ascribed to the Pythagoreans, who, when questioned as to the grounds of any assertion that they advance in debate, are said to have been accustomed to reply, 'The master said so,' the master being Pythagoras. So potent an opinion already decided, making authority prevail unsupported by reason." The Pythagoreans were fascinated by the regular solids, symmetrical three-dimensional objects, all of whose sides are the same regular polygon. The cube is the simplest example, having six squares as sides. There are an infinite number of regular polygons, but only five regular solids. For some reason, knowledge of a solid called the dodecahedron, having 12 pentagons as sides, seemed to them dangerous. It was mystically associated with the cosmos. The other four regular solids were identified somehow with the four elements, then imagined to constitute the world: earth, fire, air, and water. The fifth regular solid must then, they thought, correspond to some fifth element that could only be the substance of the heavenly bodies. This notion of a fifth essence is the origin of our word quintessence. Ordinary people were to be kept ignorant of the dodecahedron. In love with whole numbers, the Pythagoreans believed all things could be derived from them, certainly all other numbers. A crisis in doctrine arose when they discovered that the square root of 2, the ratio of the diagonal to the side of a square, was irrational, that the square root of 2 cannot be expressed accurately as the ratio of any two whole numbers, no matter how big these numbers are. Ironically, this discovery was made with the Pythagorean theorem as a tool. Irrational originally meant only that a number could not be expressed as a ratio. But for the Pythagoreans, it came to mean something threatening, a hint that their worldview might not make sense, which is today the other meaning of irrational. Instead of sharing these important mathematical discoveries, the Pythagoreans suppressed the knowledge of the square root of 2 and the dodecahedron. The outside world was not to know. Even today, there are scientists opposed to the popularization of science. The sacred knowledge is to be kept within the cult, unsullied by public understanding. The Pythagoreans believed the sphere to be perfect, all points on its surface being at the same distance from its center. Circles were also perfect. and the Pythagoreans insisted that planets moved in circular paths at constant speeds. They seemed to believe that moving slower or faster at different places in the orbit would be unseemly. Non-circular motion was somehow flawed, unsuitable for the planets, which, being free of the Earth, were also deemed perfect. The pros and cons of the Pythagorean tradition can be seen clearly in the life's work of Johannes Kepler. The Pythagorean idea of a perfect and mystical world unseen by the senses was readily accepted by the early Christians and was an integral component of Kepler's early training. On the one hand, Kepler was convinced that mathematical harmonies exist in nature. He wrote that the universe was stamped with the adornment of harmonic proportions, that simple numerical relationships must determine the motion of the planets. On the other hand, again, following the Pythagoreans, he long believed that only uniform circular motion was admissible. He repeatedly found that the observed planetary motions could not be explained in this way and repeatedly tried again. But unlike many Pythagoreans, he believed in observation and experiment in the real world. Eventually, the detailed observations of the apparent motion of the planets forced him to abandon the idea of circular paths and to realize that planets travel in ellipses. Kepler was both inspired in his search for the harmony of planetary motion and delayed for more than a decade by the attractions of Pythagorean doctrine. A disdain for the practical swept the ancient world. Plato urged astronomers to think about the heavens, but not to waste their time observing them. Aristotle believed that the lower sort are by nature slaves, and it is better for them, as for all inferiors, that they should be under the rule of a master. The slave shares in his master's life. The artisan is less closely connected with him, and only attains excellence in proportion as he becomes a slave. The meaner sort of mechanic has a special and separate slavery. Plutarch wrote, "It does not of necessity follow that if the work delight you with its grace, the one who wrought it is worthy of esteem." Xenophon's opinion was, "What are called the mechanical arts carry a social stigma and are rightly dishonored in our cities." As a result of such attitudes, the brilliant and promising Ionian experimental method was largely abandoned for 2,000 years. Without experiment, there is no way to choose among contending hypotheses, no way for science to advance. The anti-empirical taint of the Pythagoreans survives to this day. But why? Where did this distaste for experiment come from? An explanation for the decline of ancient science has been put forward by the historian of science, Benjamin Farrington. The mercantile tradition which led to Ionian science also led to a slave economy. The owning of slaves was the road to wealth and power. Polycrates' fortifications were built by slaves. Athens, in the time of Pericles, Plato, and Aristotle, had a vast slave population. All the brave Athenian talk about democracy applied only to a privileged few. What slaves characteristically perform is manual labor. But scientific experimentation is manual labor, from which the slaveholders are preferentially distanced. While it is only the slaveholders, politely called gentlemen in some societies, who have the leisure to do science. Accordingly, almost no one did science. The Ionians were perfectly able to make machines of some elegance, but the availability of slaves undermined the economic motive for the development of technology. Thus, the mercantile tradition contributed to the great Ionian awakening around 600 BC and, through slavery, may have been the cause of its decline some two centuries later. There are great ironies here. Similar trends are apparent throughout the world. The high point in indigenous Chinese astronomy occurred around 1280 with the work of Kuo Shaoqing, who used an observational baseline of 1500 years and improved both astronomical instruments and mathematical techniques for computation. It is generally thought that Chinese astronomy thereafter underwent a steep decline. Nathan Sivan believes that the reason lies at least partly in increasing rigidity of elite attitudes, so that the educated were less inclined to be curious about techniques and less willing to value science as an appropriate pursuit for a gentleman. The occupation of astronomer became a hereditary office, a practice inconsistent with the advance of the subject. Additionally, the responsibility for the evolution of astronomy remained centered in the imperial court and was largely abandoned to foreign technicians, chiefly the Jesuits, who had introduced Euclid and Copernicus to the astonished Chinese, but who, after the censorship of the latter's book, had a vested interest in disguising and suppressing heliocentric cosmology. Perhaps science was stillborn in Indian, Mayan, and Aztec civilizations for the same reason it declined in Ionia, the pervasiveness of the slave economy. A major problem in the contemporary political third world is that the educated classes tend to be the children of the wealthy, with a vested interest in the status quo, and are unaccustomed either to working with their hands or to challenging conventional wisdom. Science has been very slow to take root. Plato and Aristotle were comfortable in a slave society. They offered justifications for oppression. They served tyrants. They taught the alienation of the body from the mind, a natural enough ideal in a slave society. They separated matter from thought. They divorced the earth from the heavens, divisions that were to dominate Western thinking for more than 20 centuries. Plato, who believed that all things are full of gods, actually used the metaphor of slavery to connect his politics with his cosmology. He is said to have urged the burning of all the books of Democritus. He had a similar recommendation for the books of Homer, perhaps because Democritus did not acknowledge immortal souls or immortal gods or Pythagorean mysticism, or because he believed in an infinite number of worlds. Of the 73 books Democritus is said to have written, covering all of human knowledge, not a single work survives. All we know is from fragments, chiefly on ethics and secondhand accounts. The same is true of almost all other ancient Ionian scientists. In the recognition by Pythagoras and Plato that the cosmos is knowable, that there is a mathematical underpinning to nature, they greatly advanced the cause of science. But in the suppression of disquieting facts, the sense that science should be kept for a small elite, the distaste for experiment, the embrace of mysticism, and the easy acceptance of slave societies, they set back the human enterprise. After a long mystical sleep, in which the tools of scientific inquiry lay moldering, the Ionian approach, in some cases transmitted through scholars at the Alexandrian Library, was finally rediscovered. The Western world reawakened. Experiment and open inquiry became once more respectable. Forgotten books and fragments were again read. Leonardo and Columbus and Copernicus were inspired by, or independently retraced, parts of this ancient Greek tradition. There is, in our time, much Ionian science, although not in politics and religion, and a fair amount of courageous free inquiry. But there are also appalling superstitions and deadly ethical ambiguities. We are flawed by ancient contradictions. The Platonists and their Christian successors held the peculiar notion that the earth was tainted and somehow nasty, while the heavens were perfect and divine. The fundamental idea that the earth is a planet, that we are citizens of the universe, was rejected and forgotten. This idea was first argued by Aristarchus, born on Samos 3 centuries after Pythagoras. Aristarchus was one of the last of the Ionian scientists. By this time, the center of intellectual enlightenment had moved to the great library of Alexandria. Aristarchus was the first person to hold that the sun, rather than the earth, is at the center of the planetary system, that all the planets go around the sun rather than the earth. Typically, his writings on this matter are lost. From the size of the Earth's shadow on the moon during a lunar eclipse, he deduced that the sun had to be much larger than the Earth, as well as very far away. He may then have reasoned that it is absurd for so large a body as the sun to revolve around so small a body as the earth. He put the sun at the center, made the earth rotate on its axis once a day, and orbit the sun once a year. It is the same idea we associate with the name of Copernicus, whom Galileo described as the restorer and confirmer, not the inventor, of the heliocentric hypothesis. For most of the 1800 years between Aristarchus and Copernicus, nobody knew the correct disposition of the planets, even though it had been laid out perfectly clearly around 280 BC. The idea outraged some of Aristarchus' contemporaries. There were cries, like those voiced about Anaxagoras and Bruno and Galileo, that he be condemned for impiety. The resistance to Aristarchus and Copernicus, a kind of geocentrism in everyday life, remains with us. We still talk about the sun rising and the sun setting. It is 2,200 years since Aristarchus, and our language still pretends that the earth does not turn. The separation of the planets from one another, 40 million kilometers from Earth to Venus at closest approach, 6 billion kilometers to Pluto, would have stunned those Greeks who were outraged by the contention that the sun might be as large as the Peloponnesus. It was natural to think of the solar system as much more compact and local. If I hold my finger before my eyes and examine it first with my left and then with my right eye, it seems to move against the distant background. The closer my finger is, the more it seems to move. I can estimate the distance to my finger from the amount of this apparent motion, or parallax. If my eyes were farther apart, my finger would seem to move substantially more. The longer the baseline from which we make our two observations, the greater the parallax and the better we can measure the distance to remote objects. But we live on a moving platform. The Earth, which every 6 months has progressed from one end of its orbit to the other, a distance of 300 million kilometers. If we look at the same unmoving celestial object 6 months apart, we should be able to measure very great distances. Aristarchus suspected the stars to be distant suns. He placed the sun among the fixed stars. The absence of detectable stellar parallax as the Earth moved suggested that the stars were much farther away than the sun. Before the invention of the telescope, the parallax of even the nearest stars was too small to detect. Not until the 19th century was the parallax of a star first measured. It then became clear from straightforward Greek geometry that the stars were light years away. There is another way to measure the distance to the stars, which the Ionians were fully capable of discovering, although, so far as we know, they did not employ it. Everyone knows that the farther away an object is, the smaller it seems. This inverse proportionality between apparent size and distance is the basis of perspective in art and photography. So the farther away we are from the sun, the smaller and dimmer it appears. How far would we have to be from the sun for it to appear as small and as dim as a star? Or, equivalently, how small a piece of the sun would be as bright as a star? An early experiment to answer this question was performed by Christian Huygens, very much in the Ionian tradition. Huygens drilled small holes in a brass plate, held the plate up to the sun, and asked himself which hole seemed as bright as he remembered the bright star Sirius to have been the night before. The hole was effectively 1/28,000th the apparent size of the sun. So, Sirius, he reasoned, must be 28,000 times farther from us than the sun, or about half a light year away. It is hard to remember just how bright a star is many hours after you look at it, but Huygens remembered very well. If he had known that Sirius was intrinsically brighter than the sun, he would have come up with almost exactly the right answer. Sirius is 8.8 light years away. The fact that Aristarchus and Huygens used imprecise data and derived imperfect answers hardly matters. They explained their methods so clearly that when better observations were available, more accurate answers could be derived. Between the times of Aristarchus and Huygens, humans answered the question that had so excited me as a boy growing up in Brooklyn. What are the stars? The answer is that the stars are mighty suns, light years away in the vastness of interstellar space. The great legacy of Aristarchus is this: neither we nor our planet enjoys a privileged position in nature. This insight has since been applied upward to the stars and sideways to many subsets of the human family with great success and invariable opposition. It has been responsible for major advances in astronomy, physics, biology, anthropology, economics, and politics. I wonder if its social extrapolation is a major reason for attempts at its suppression. The legacy of Aristarchus has been extended far beyond the realm of the stars. At the end of the 18th century, William Herschel, musician and astronomer to George III of England, completed a project to map the starry skies and found apparently equal numbers of stars in all directions in the plane or band of the Milky Way. From this, reasonably enough, he deduced that we were at the center of the galaxy. Just before World War I, Harlow Shapley of Missouri devised a technique for measuring the distances to the globular clusters, those lovely spherical arrays of stars which resemble a swarm of bees. Shapley had found a stellar standard candle, a star noticeable because of its variability, but which had always the same average intrinsic brightness. By comparing the faintness of such stars when found in globular clusters with their real brightness, as determined from nearby representatives, Shapley could calculate how far away they are, just as, in a field, we can estimate the distance of a lantern of known intrinsic brightness from the feeble light that reaches us, essentially the method of Huygens. Shapley discovered that the globular clusters were not centered around the solar neighborhood, but rather about a distant region of the Milky Way, in the direction of the constellation Sagittarius, the Archer. It seemed to him very likely that the globular clusters used in this investigation, nearly 100 of them, would be orbiting about, paying homage to the massive center of the Milky Way. Shapley had, in 1915, the courage to propose that the solar system was in the outskirts and not near the core of our galaxy. Herschel had been misled because of the copious amount of obscuring dust in the direction of Sagittarius. He had no way to know of the enormous numbers of stars beyond. It is now very clear that we live some 30,000 light years from the galactic core, on the fringes of a spiral arm where the local density of stars is relatively sparse. There may be those who live on a planet that orbits a central star in one of Shapley's globular clusters or one located in the core. Such beings may pity us for our handful of naked-eye stars because their skies will be ablaze with them. Near the center of the Milky Way, millions of brilliant stars would be visible to the naked eye compared to our paltry few thousand. Our sun or suns might set, but the night would never come. Well into the 20th century, astronomers believed that there was only one galaxy in the cosmos, the Milky Way. Although in the 18th century, Thomas Wright of Durban and Immanuel Kant of Königsberg each had a premonition that the exquisite luminous spiral forms, viewed through the telescope, were other galaxies. Kant suggested explicitly that M31 in the constellation Andromeda was another Milky Way composed of enormous numbers of stars, and proposed calling such objects by the evocative and haunting phrase island universes. Some scientists toyed with the idea that the spiral nebulae were not distant island universes, but rather nearby condensing clouds of interstellar gas, perhaps on their way to make solar systems. To test the distance of the spiral nebulae, A class of intrinsically much brighter variable stars was needed to furnish a new standard candle. Such stars, identified in M31 by Edwin Hubble in 1924, were discovered to be alarmingly dim, and it became apparent that M31 was a prodigious distance away, a number now estimated at a little more than 2 million light years. But if M31 were at such a distance, it could not be a cloud of mere interstellar dimensions. It had to be much larger, an immense galaxy in its own right. And the other, fainter galaxies, must be more distant still, 100 billion of them sprinkled through the dark to the frontiers of the known cosmos. As long as there have been humans, we have searched for our place in the cosmos. In the childhood of our species, when our ancestors gazed a little idly at the stars, among the Ionian scientists of ancient Greece, and in our own age, we have been transfixed by this question. Where are we? Who are we? We find that we live on an insignificant planet of a humdrum star, lost between two spiral arms in the outskirts of a galaxy which is a member of a sparse cluster of galaxies, tucked away in some forgotten corner of a universe in which there are far more galaxies than people. This perspective is a courageous continuation of our penchant for constructing and testing mental models of the skies, the sun as a red-hot stone, the stars as celestial flame, the galaxy as the backbone of night. Since Aristarchus, every step in our quest has moved us farther from center stage in the cosmic drama. There has not been much time to assimilate these new findings. The discoveries of Shapley and Hubble were made within the lifetimes of many people still alive today. There are those who secretly deplore these great discoveries, who consider every step a demotion, who, in their heart of hearts, still pine for a universe whose center, focus, and fulcrum is the Earth. But if we are to deal with the cosmos, we must first understand it. Even if our hopes for some unearned preferential status are, in the process, contravened. Understanding where we live is an essential precondition for improving the neighborhood. Knowing what other neighborhoods are like also helps. If we long for our planet to be important, there is something we can do about it. We make our world significant by the courage of our questions and by the depth of our answers. We embarked on our cosmic voyage with a question first framed in the childhood of our species and in each generation asked anew with undiminished wonder. What are the stars? Exploration is in our nature. We began as wanderers, and we are wanderers still. We have lingered long enough on the shores of the cosmic ocean. We are ready at last to set sail for the stars. Chapter 8: Travels in Space and Time. We have loved the stars too fondly to be fearful of the night. Tombstone epitaph of two amateur astronomers. The rising and falling of the surf is produced in part by tides. The moon and sun are far away, but their gravitational influence is very real and noticeable back here on Earth. The beach reminds us of space. Fine sand grains, all more or less uniform in size, have been produced from larger rocks through ages of jostling and rubbing, abrasion and erosion, again, driven through waves and weather by the distant moon and sun. The beach also reminds us of time. The world is much older than the human species. A handful of sand contains about 10,000 grains, more than the number of stars we can see with the naked eye on a clear night. But the number of stars we can see is only the tiniest fraction of the number of stars that are. What we see at night is the merest smattering of the nearest stars. Meanwhile, the cosmos is rich beyond measure. The total number of stars in the universe is greater than all the grains of sand on all the beaches of the planet Earth. Despite the efforts of ancient astronomers and astrologers to put pictures in the skies, a constellation is nothing more than an arbitrary grouping of stars, composed of intrinsically dim stars that seem to us bright because they are nearby, and intrinsically brighter stars that are somewhat more distant. All places on Earth are, to high precision, the same distance from any star. This is why the star patterns in a given constellation do not change as we go from, say, Soviet Central Asia to the American Midwest. Astronomically, the USSR and the United States are the same place. The stars in any constellation are all so far away that we cannot recognize them as a three-dimensional configuration as long as we are tied to Earth. The average distance between the stars is a few light years. A light year being, we remember, about 10 trillion kilometers. For the patterns of the constellations to change, we must travel over distances comparable to those that separate the stars. We must venture across light years. Then, some nearby stars will seem to move out of the constellation. Others will enter it, and its configuration will alter dramatically. Our technology is, so far, utterly incapable of such grand interstellar voyages, at least in reasonable transit times. But our computers can be taught the three-dimensional positions of all the nearby stars, and we can ask to be taken on a little trip, a circumnavigation of the collection of bright stars that constitute the Big Dipper, say, and watch the constellations change. We connect the stars in typical constellations, in the usual celestial follow-the-dots drawings. As we change our perspective, we see their apparent shapes distort severely. The inhabitants of the planets of distant stars witness quite different constellations in their night skies than we do in ours. Other Rorschach tests for other minds. Perhaps sometime in the next few centuries, a spaceship from Earth will actually travel such distances at some remarkable speed and see new constellations that no human has ever viewed before, except with such a computer. The appearance of the constellations changes not only in space, but also in time. Not only if we alter our position, but also if we merely wait sufficiently long. Sometimes stars move together in a group or cluster. Other times, a single star may move very rapidly with respect to its fellows. Eventually, such stars leave an old constellation and enter a new one. Occasionally, one member of a double star system explodes, breaking the gravitational shackles that bound its companion, which then leaps into space at its former orbital velocity, a slingshot in the sky. In addition, stars are born, stars evolve, and stars die. If we wait long enough, new stars appear and old stars vanish. The patterns in the sky slowly melt and alter. Even over the lifetime of the human species, a few million years, constellations have been changing. Consider the present configuration of the Big Dipper, or Great Bear. Our computer can carry us in time as well as in space. As we run the Big Dipper backward into the past, allowing for the motion of its stars, we find quite a different appearance a million years ago. The Big Dipper then looked quite a bit like a spear. If a time machine dropped you precipitously in some unknown age in the distant past, you could, in principle, determine the epoch by the configuration of the stars. If the Big Dipper is a spear, this must be the Middle Pleistocene. We can also ask the computer to run a constellation forward into time. Consider Leo the Lion. The zodiac is a band of 12 constellations seemingly wrapped around the sky in the apparent annual path of the sun through the heavens. The root of the word is that for zoo, because the zodiacal constellations, like Leo, are mainly fancied to be animals. A million years from now, Leo will look still less like a lion than it does today. Perhaps our remote descendants will call it the constellation of the radio telescope, although I suspect a million years from now, the radio telescope will become more obsolete than the stone spear is now. The non-zodiacal constellation of Orion the Hunter, is outlined by four bright stars and bisected by a diagonal line of three stars, which represent the belt of the Hunter. Three dimmer stars hanging from the belt are, according to the conventional astronomical projective test, Orion's Sword. The middle star in the Sword is not actually a star, but a great cloud of gas called the Orion Nebula, in which stars are being born. Many of the stars in Orion are hot and young, evolving rapidly and ending their lives in colossal cosmic explosions called supernovae. They are born and die in periods of tens of millions of years. If, on our computer, we were to run Orion rapidly into the far future, we would see a startling effect, the births and spectacular deaths of many of its stars flashing on and winking off like fireflies in the night. The solar neighborhood, the immediate environs of the sun in space, include the nearest star system, Alpha Centauri. It is really a triple system, two stars revolving around each other and a third, Proxima Centauri, orbiting the pair at a discrete distance. At some positions in its orbit, Proxima is the closest known star to the sun, hence its name. Most stars in the sky are members of double or multiple star systems. Our solitary sun is something of an anomaly. The second brightest star in the constellation Andromeda, called Beta Andromedae, is 75 light years away. The light by which we see it now has spent 75 years traversing the dark of interstellar space on its long journey to Earth. In the unlikely event that Beta Andromedae blew itself up last Tuesday, we would not know it for another 75 years, as this interesting information, traveling at the speed of light, would require 75 years to cross the enormous interstellar distances. When the light by which we now see this star set out on its long voyage, the young Albert Einstein, working as a Swiss patent clerk, had just published his epical special theory of relativity here on Earth. Space and time are interwoven. We cannot look out into space without looking back into time. Light travels very fast, but space is very empty, and the stars are far apart. Distances of 75 light years or less are very small compared to other distances in astronomy. From the sun to the center of the Milky Way galaxy is 30,000 light years. From our galaxy to the nearest spiral galaxy, M31, also in the constellation Andromeda, is 2 million light years. When the light we see today from M31 left for Earth, there were no humans on our planet, although our ancestors were evolving rapidly to our present form. The distance from the Earth to the most remote quasars is 8 or 10 billion light years. We see them today as they were before the Earth accumulated, before the Milky Way was formed. This is not a situation restricted to astronomical objects, but only astronomical objects are so far away that the finite speed of light becomes important. If you are looking at a friend 3 meters, 10 feet away, at the other end of the room, you are not seeing her as she is now, but rather as she was 1/100,000,000th of a second ago, or 1/100th of a microsecond. In this calculation, we have merely divided the distance by the speed to get the travel time. But the difference between your friend now and now minus 1/100,000,000th of a second is too small to notice. On the other hand, when we look at a quasar 8 billion light years away, the fact that we are seeing it as it was 8 billion years ago may be very important. For example, there are those who think that quasars are explosive events likely to happen only in the early history of galaxies. In that case, the more distant the galaxy, the earlier in its history we are observing it, and the more likely it is that we should see it as a quasar. Indeed, the number of quasars increases as we look to distances of more than about 5 billion light years. The two Voyager interstellar spacecraft, the fastest machines ever launched from Earth, are now traveling at 1/10,000th the speed of light. They would need 40,000 years to go the distance to the nearest star. Do we have any hope of leaving Earth and traversing the immense distances, even to Proxima Centauri, in convenient periods of time? Can we do something to approach the speed of light? What is magic about the speed of light? Might we someday be able to go faster than that? If you had walked through the pleasant Tuscan countryside in the 1890s, you might have come upon a somewhat long-haired teenage high school dropout on the road to Pavia. His teachers in Germany had told him that he would never amount to anything, that his questions destroyed classroom discipline, that he would be better off out of school. So he left and wandered, delighting in the freedom of northern Italy, where he could ruminate on matters remote from the subjects he had been force-fed in his highly disciplined Prussian schoolroom. His name was Albert Einstein, and his ruminations changed the world. Einstein had been fascinated by Bernstein's People's Book of Natural Science, a popularization of science that described on its very first page the astonishing speed of electricity through wires and light through space. He wondered what the world would look like if you could travel on a wave of light. To travel at the speed of light? What an engaging and magical thought for a boy on the road in a countryside dappled and rippling in sunlight. You could not tell you were on a light wave if you traveled with it. If you started on a wave crest, you would stay on the crest and lose all notion of it being a wave. Something strange happens at the speed of light. The more Einstein thought about such questions, the more troubling they became. Paradoxes seemed to emerge everywhere if you could travel at the speed of light. Certain ideas had been accepted as true without sufficiently careful thought. Einstein posed simple questions that could have been asked centuries earlier. For example, what do we mean when we say that two events are simultaneous? Imagine that I am riding a bicycle toward you. As I approach an intersection, I nearly collide, so it seems to me, with a horse-drawn cart. I swerve and barely avoid being run over. Now, think of the event again and imagine that the cart and the bicycle are both traveling close to the speed of light. If you are standing down the road, the cart is traveling at right angles to your line of sight. You see me, by reflected sunlight, traveling toward you. Would not my speed be added to the speed of light so that my image would get to you considerably before the image of the cart? Should you not see me swerve before you see the cart arrive? Can the cart and I approach the intersection simultaneously from my point of view, but not from yours? Could I experience a near collision with the cart while you perhaps see me swerve around nothing and pedal cheerfully on toward the town of Vinci? These are curious and subtle questions. They challenge the obvious. There is a reason that no one thought of them before Einstein. From such elementary questions, Einstein produced a fundamental rethinking of the world, a revolution in physics. If the world is to be understood, if we are to avoid such logical paradoxes when traveling at high speeds, there are some rules, commandments of nature that must be obeyed. Einstein codified these rules in the special theory of relativity. Light, reflected or emitted from an object, travels at the same velocity whether the object is moving or stationary. Thou shalt not add thy speed to the speed of light. Also, no material object may move faster than light. Thou shalt not travel at or beyond the speed of light. Nothing in physics prevents you from traveling as close to the speed of light as you like. 99.9% of the speed of light would be just fine. But no matter how hard you try, you can never gain that last decimal point. For the world to be logically consistent, there must be a cosmic speed limit. Otherwise, you could get to any speed you wanted by adding velocities on a moving platform. Europeans, around the turn of the century, generally believed in privileged frames of reference, that German or French or British culture and political organization were better than those of other countries, that Europeans were superior to other peoples who were fortunate enough to be colonized. The social and political application of the ideas of Aristarchus and Copernicus was rejected or ignored. The young Einstein rebelled against the notion of privileged frames of reference in physics as much as he did in politics. In a universe filled with stars rushing helter-skelter in all directions, there was no place that was at rest, no framework from which to view the universe that was superior to any other framework. This is what the word relativity means. The idea is very simple. Despite its magical trappings, in viewing the universe, every place is as good as every other place. The laws of nature must be identical no matter who is describing them. If this is to be true, and it would be stunning if there were something special about our insignificant location in the cosmos, then it follows that no one may travel faster than light. We hear the crack of a bullwhip because its tip is moving faster than the speed of sound, creating a shockwave, a small sonic boom. A thunderclap has a similar origin. It was once thought that airplanes could not travel faster than sound. Today, supersonic flight is commonplace, but the light barrier is different from the sound barrier. It is not merely an engineering problem like the one the supersonic airplane solves. It is a fundamental law of nature, as basic as gravity. And there are no phenomena in our experience, like the crack of the bullwhip or the clap of thunder for sound, to suggest the possibility of traveling in a vacuum faster than light. On the contrary, there is an extremely wide range of experience, with nuclear accelerators and atomic clocks, for example, in precise quantitative agreement with special relativity. The problems of simultaneity do not apply to sound as they do to light because sound is propagated through some material medium, usually air. The sound waves that reach you when a friend is talking is the motion of molecules in the air. Light, however, travels in a vacuum. There are restrictions on how molecules of air can move which do not apply to a vacuum. Light from the sun reaches us across the intervening empty space, but no matter how carefully we listen, we do not hear the crackle of sunspots or the thunder of the solar flares. It was once thought, in the days before relativity, that light did propagate through a special medium that permeated all of space called the luminiferous ether. But the famous Michelson-Morley experiment demonstrated that such an ether does not exist. We sometimes hear of things that can travel faster than light. Something called the speed of thought is occasionally proffered. This is an exceptionally silly notion, especially since the speed of impulses through the neurons in our brains is about the same as the speed of a donkey cart. That human beings have been clever enough to devise relativity shows that we think well, but I do not think we can boast about thinking fast. The electrical impulses in modern computers do, however, travel nearly at the speed of light. Special relativity, fully worked out by Einstein in his middle 20s, is supported by every experiment performed to check it. Perhaps tomorrow, someone will invent a theory consistent with everything else we know that circumvents paradoxes on such matters as simultaneity, avoids privileged reference frames, and still permits travel faster than light. But I doubt it very much. Einstein's prohibition against traveling faster than light may clash with our common sense, but on this question, why should we trust common sense? Why should our experience at 10 kilometers an hour constrain the laws of nature at 300,000 kilometers per second? Relativity does set limits on what humans can ultimately do, but the universe is not required to be in perfect harmony with human ambition. Special relativity removes from our grasp one way of reaching the stars, the ship that can go faster than light. Tantalizingly, it suggests another and quite unexpected method. Following George Gamow, let us imagine a place where the speed of light is not its true value of 300,000 kilometers per second, but something very modest, 40 kilometers per hour, say, and strictly enforced. There are no penalties for breaking laws of nature because there are no crimes. Nature is self-regulating and merely arranges things so that its prohibitions are impossible to transgress. Imagine that you are approaching the speed of light on a motor scooter. Relativity is rich in sentences beginning, imagine. Einstein called such an exercise a Gedanken experiment, a thought experiment. As your speed increases, you begin to see around the corners of passing objects. While you are rigidly facing forward, things that are behind you appear within your forward field of vision. Close to the speed of light, from your point of view, the world looks very odd. Ultimately, everything is squeezed into a tiny circular window, which stays just ahead of you. From the standpoint of a stationary observer, light reflected off you is reddened as you depart and blued as you return. If you travel toward the observer at almost the speed of light, you will become enveloped in an eerie chromatic radiance. Your usually invisible infrared emission will be shifted to the shorter visible wavelengths. You become compressed in the direction of motion. Your mass increases, and time, as you experience it, slows down, a breathtaking consequence of traveling close to the speed of light called time dilation. But from the standpoint of an observer moving with you, perhaps the scooter has a second seat, none of these effects occur. These peculiar and at first perplexing predictions of special relativity are true in the deepest sense that anything in science is true. They depend on your relative motion, but they are real, not optical illusions. They can be demonstrated by simple mathematics, mainly first-year algebra, and therefore understandable to any educated person. They are also consistent with many experiments. Very accurate clocks carried in airplanes slow down a little compared to stationary clocks. Nuclear accelerators are designed to allow for the increase of mass with increasing speed. If they were not designed in this way, accelerated particles would all smash into the walls of the apparatus, and there would be little to do in experimental nuclear physics. A speed is a distance divided by a time. Since near the velocity of light, we cannot simply add speeds, as we are used to doing in the workaday world, the familiar notions of absolute space and absolute time, independent of your relative motion, must give way. That is why you shrink. That is the reason for time dilation. Traveling close to the speed of light, you would hardly age at all, but your friends and your relatives back home would be aging at the usual rate. When you returned from your relativistic journey, what a difference there would be between your friends and you, they having aged decades, say, and you having aged hardly at all. Traveling close to the speed of light is a kind of elixir of life. Because time slows down close to the speed of light, special relativity provides us with a means of going to the stars. But is it possible, in terms of practical engineering, to travel close to the speed of light? Is a starship feasible? Tuscany was not only the cauldron of some of the thinking of the young Albert Einstein. It was also the home of another great genius who lived 400 years earlier, Leonardo da Vinci, who delighted in climbing the Tuscan hills and viewing the ground from a great height, as if he were soaring like a bird. He drew the first aerial perspectives of landscapes, towns, and fortifications. Among Leonardo's many interests and accomplishments in painting, sculpture, anatomy, geology, natural history, military, and civil engineering, he had a great passion to devise and fabricate a machine that could fly. He drew pictures, constructed models, built full-size prototypes, and not one of them worked. No sufficiently powerful and lightweight engine then existed. The designs, however, were brilliant and encouraged the engineers of future times. Leonardo himself was depressed by these failures, but it was hardly his fault. He was trapped in the 15th century. A similar case occurred in 1939 when a group of engineers calling themselves the British Interplanetary Society designed a ship to take people to the moon using 1939 technology. It was by no means identical to the design of the Apollo spacecraft, which accomplished exactly this mission three decades later, but it suggested that a mission to the moon might one day be a practical engineering possibility. Today, we have preliminary designs for ships to take people to the stars. None of these spacecraft is imagined to leave the Earth directly. Rather, they are constructed in Earth orbit from where they are launched on their long interstellar journeys. One of them was called Project Orion, after the constellation, a reminder that the ship's ultimate objective was the stars. Orion was designed to utilize explosions of hydrogen bombs, nuclear weapons, against an inertial plate, each explosion providing a kind of putt-putt, a vast nuclear motorboat in space. Orion seems entirely practical from an engineering point of view. By its very nature, it would have produced vast quantities of radioactive debris, but for conscientious mission profiles only in the emptiness of interplanetary or interstellar space. Orion was under serious development in the United States until the signing of the international treaty that forbids the detonation of nuclear weapons in space. This seems to me a great pity. The Orion starship is the best use of nuclear weapons I can think of. Project Daedalus is a recent design of the British Interplanetary Society. It assumes the existence of a nuclear fusion reactor, something much safer as well as more efficient than existing fission power plants. We do not have fusion reactors yet, but they are confidently expected in the new few decades. Orion and Daedalus might travel at 10% the speed of light. A trip to Alpha Centauri, 4.3 light years away, would then take 43 years, less than a human lifetime. Such ships could not travel close enough to the speed of light for special relativistic time dilation to become important. Even with optimistic projections on the development of our technology, it does not seem likely that Orion, Daedalus, or their ilk will be built before the middle of the 21st century. Although, if we wished, we could build Orion now. For voyages beyond the nearest stars, something else must be done. Perhaps Orion and Daedalus could be used as multi-generation ships, so those arriving at a planet of another star would be the remote descendants of those who had set out some centuries before. Or perhaps a safe means of hibernation for humans will be found, so that the space travelers could be frozen and then reawakened centuries later. These non-relativistic starships, enormously expensive as they would be, look relatively easy to design and build and use compared to starships that travel close to the speed of light. Other star systems are accessible to the human species, but only after great effort. Fast interstellar spaceflight, with the ship velocity approaching the speed of light, is an objective not for 100 years, but for 1,000 or 10,000. But it is, in principle, possible. A kind of interstellar ramjet has been proposed by R.W. Bussard, which scoops up the diffuse matter, mostly hydrogen atoms, that floats between the stars, accelerates it into a fusion engine, and ejects it out the back. The hydrogen would be used both as fuel and as reaction mass. But in deep space, there is only about one atom in every 10 cubic centimeters, a volume the size of a grape. For the ramjet to work, it needs a frontal scoop hundreds of kilometers across. When the ship reaches relativistic velocities, the hydrogen atoms will be moving with respect to the spaceship at close to the speed of light. If adequate precautions are not taken, the spaceship and its passengers will be fried by these induced cosmic rays. One proposed solution uses a laser to strip the electrons off the interstellar atoms and make them electrically charged while they are still some distance away, and an extremely strong magnetic field to deflect the charged atoms into the scoop and away from the rest of the spacecraft. This is engineering on a scale so far unprecedented on Earth. We are talking of engines the size of small worlds. But let us spend a moment thinking about such a ship. The Earth gravitationally attracts us with a certain force, which, if we are falling, we experience as an acceleration. Were we to fall out of a tree, and many of our proto-human ancestors must have done so, we would plummet faster and faster, increasing our fall speed by 10 meters, or 32 feet, per second every second. This acceleration, which characterizes the force of gravity holding us to the Earth's surface, is called 1G, G for Earth gravity. We are comfortable with accelerations of 1G. We have grown up with 1G. If we lived in an interstellar spacecraft that could accelerate at 1G, we would find ourselves in a perfectly natural environment. In fact, the equivalence between gravitational forces and the forces we would feel in an accelerating spaceship is a major feature of Einstein's later general theory of relativity. With a continuous 1G acceleration, after 1 year in space, we would be traveling very close to the speed of light. Suppose that such a spacecraft accelerates at 1G, approaching more and more closely to the speed of light until the midpoint of the journey, and then is turned around and decelerates at 1G until arriving at its destination. For most of the trip, the velocity would be very close to the speed of light, and time would slow down enormously. A nearby mission objective, a sun that may have planets, is Barnard's star, about 6 light years away. It could be reached in about 8 years as measured by clocks aboard the ship. The center of the Milky Way in 21 years. M31, the Andromeda Galaxy, in 28 years. Of course, people left behind on Earth would see things differently. Instead of 21 years to the center of the galaxy, they would measure an elapsed time of 30,000 years. When we got home, few of our friends would be left to greet us. In principle, such a journey mounting the decimal points ever closer to the speed of light would even permit us to circumnavigate the known universe in some 56 years ship time. We would return tens of billions of years in our future to find the Earth a charred cinder and the sun dead. Relativistic spaceflight makes the universe accessible to advanced civilizations, but only to those who go on the journey. There seems to be no way for information to travel back to those left behind any faster than the speed of light. The designs for Orion, Daedalus, and the Bessard ramjet are probably farther from the actual interstellar spacecraft we will one day build than Leonardo's models are from today's supersonic transports. But if we do not destroy ourselves, I believe that we will one day venture to the stars. When our solar system is all explored, the planets of other stars will beckon. Space travel and time travel are connected. We can travel fast into space only by traveling fast into the future. But what of the past? Could we return to the past and change it? Could we make events turn out differently from what the history books assert? We travel slowly into the future all the time, at the rate of one day every day. With relativistic spaceflight, we could travel fast into the future, but many physicists believe that a voyage into the past is impossible. Even if you had a device that could travel backward in time, they say, you would be unable to do anything that would make any difference. If you journeyed into the past and prevented your parents from meeting, then you would never have been born, which is something of a contradiction since you clearly exist. Like the proof of the irrationality of the square root of 2, like the discussion of simultaneity in special relativity, this is an argument in which the premise is challenged because the conclusion seems absurd. But other physicists propose that two alternative histories, two equally valid realities, could exist side by side. The one you know and the one in which you were never born. Perhaps time itself has many potential dimensions, despite the fact that we are condemned to experience only one of them. Suppose you could go back into the past and change it, by persuading Queen Isabella not to support Christopher Columbus, for example. Then, it is argued, you would have set into motion a different sequence of historical events, which those you left behind in our timeline would never know about. If that kind of time travel were possible, then every imaginable alternative history might, in some sense, really exist. History consists, for the most part, of a complex bundle of deeply interwoven threads, social, cultural, and economic forces that are not easily unraveled. The countless small, unpredictable, and random events that flow on continually often have no long-range consequences. But some, those occurring at critical junctures or branch points, may change the pattern of history. There may be cases where profound changes can be made by relatively trivial adjustments. The farther in the past such an event is, the more powerful may be its influence because the longer the lever arm of time becomes. A poliovirus is a tiny microorganism. We encounter many of them every day, but only rarely, fortunately, does one of them infect one of us and cause this dread disease. Franklin D. Roosevelt, the 32nd President of the United States, had polio. Because the disease was crippling, it may have provided Roosevelt with a greater compassion for the underdog, or perhaps it improved his striving for success. If Roosevelt's personality had been different, or if he had never had the ambition to be President of the United States, the Great Depression of the 1930s, World War II, and the development of nuclear weapons might just possibly have turned out differently. The future of the world might have been altered. But a virus is an insignificant thing, only a millionth of a centimeter across. It is hardly anything at all. On the other hand, suppose our time traveler had persuaded Queen Isabella that Columbus's geography was faulty, that from Eratosthenes' estimate of the circumference of the earth, Columbus could never reach Asia. Almost certainly, some other European would have come along within a few decades and sailed west to the New World. Improvements in navigation, the lure of the spice trade and competition among rival European powers made the discovery of America around 1500 more or less inevitable. Of course, there would today be no nation of Columbia or District of Columbia or Columbus, Ohio or Columbia University in the Americas, but the overall course of history might have turned out more or less the same. In order to affect the future profoundly, a time traveler would probably have to intervene in a number of carefully chosen events to change the weave of history. It is a lovely fantasy to explore those worlds that never were. By visiting them, we could truly understand how history works. History could become an experimental science. If an apparently pivotal person had never lived, Plato, say, or Paul, or Peter the Great, how different would the world be? What if the scientific tradition of the ancient Ionian Greeks had survived and flourished? That would have required many of the social forces of the time to have been different, including the prevailing belief that slavery was natural and right. But what if that light that dawned in the Eastern Mediterranean 2,500 years ago had not flickered out? What if science and the experimental method and the dignity of crafts and mechanical arts had been vigorously pursued 2,000 years before the Industrial Revolution? What if the power of this new mode of thought had been more generally appreciated? I sometimes think we might then have saved 10 or 20 centuries. Perhaps the contributions of Leonardo would have been made 1,000 years ago and those of Albert Einstein 500 years ago. In such an alternate earth, Leonardo and Einstein would, of course, never have been born. Too many things would have been different. In every ejaculation, there are hundreds of millions of sperm cells, only one of which can fertilize an egg and produce a member of the next generation of human beings. But which sperm succeeds in fertilizing an egg must depend on the most minor and insignificant of factors, both internal and external. If even a little thing had gone differently 2,500 years ago, none of us would be here today. There would be billions of others living in our place. If the Ionian spirit had one, I think we, a different we, of course, might by now be venturing to the stars. Our first survey ships to Alpha Centauri and Barnard's Star, Sirius, and Tau Ceti would have returned long ago. great fleets of interstellar transports would be under construction in Earth orbit, unmanned survey ships, liners for immigrants, immense trading ships to plow the seas of space. On all these ships, there would be symbols and writing. If we looked closely, we might see that the language was Greek. And perhaps the symbol on the bow of one of the first starships would be a dodecahedron with the inscription, Starship Theodorus of the planet Earth. In the timeline of our world, things have gone somewhat more slowly. We are not yet ready for the stars, but perhaps in another century or two, when the solar system is all explored, we will also have put our planet in order. We will have the will and the resources and the technical knowledge to go to the stars. We will have examined from great distances the diversity of other planetary systems, some very much like our own and some extremely different. We will know which stars to visit. Our machines and our descendants will then skim the light years, the children of Thales and Aristarchus, Leonardo and Einstein. We are not yet certain how many planetary systems there are, but there seem to be a great abundance. In our immediate vicinity, there is not just one, but in a sense, four. Jupiter, Saturn, and Uranus each has a satellite system that, in the relative sizes and spacings of the moons, resembles closely the planets about the sun. Extrapolation of the statistics of double stars, which are greatly disparate in mass, suggests that almost all single stars, like the sun, should have planetary companions. We cannot yet directly see the planets of other stars, tiny points of light swamped in the brilliance of their local suns. But we are becoming able to detect the gravitational influence of an unseen planet on an observed star. Imagine such a star with a large proper motion moving over decades against the backdrop of more distant constellations, and with a large planet, the mass of Jupiter, say, whose orbital plane is by chance aligned at right angles to our line of sight. When the dark planet is, from our perspective, to the right of the star will be pulled a little to the right, and conversely, when the planet is to the left. Consequently, the path of the star will be altered or perturbed from a straight line to a wavy one. The nearest star for which this gravitational perturbation method can be applied is Barnard's star, the nearest single star. The complex interactions of the three stars in the Alpha Centauri system would make the search for a low-mass companion there very difficult.